You may proceed.
Thank you, Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Marcus Scriven. I represent the appellant, Ms. April Howard Hunter in this case. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if
Did
I may.
Say three?
Yes.
All right.
Your Honor, this case is clearly one of a manifest injustice to Ms. Hunter. In this case, Ms. Hunter was 31 years of age. The mother, single mother, a four-month-old child, when the defendant caused a subject accident. Your Honor, we believe this case falls under the case of the Carter case that I cited in my brief. In that case, a slip opinion. The facts are pretty close to our facts in that the defendant admitted liability for negligence.
After you non-suited the simple negligence, or your client non-suited the simple negligence count,
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the first part of that.
After the non-suit of the simple negligence complaint?
Yes.
And the refiling of the gross negligence complaint, why didn't you add a simple negligence count identical to the one that was non-suited? And how did you not know that that would lead a defense to believe that that had been abandoned for whatever reason?
Your Honor, because, first of all, if I may explain, the reason why we changed the cause of action first is because prior counsel just filed a complaint without doing any investigation and not talking to witnesses and not going to the scene of the accident. As soon as I became involved with the case, I talked to witnesses, I went to the scene of the accident, and it was clear that the defendant had pulled out without stopping at the stop sign.
Okay, let's say that it was a great idea to file a gross negligence count. My question is, why didn't you also refile the count that was non-suited, which is simple negligence? And similarly, why on the eve of trial, the first trial, the trial that ended in mistrial, all of your jury instructions were gross negligence jury instructions, which would lead me, if I were a defense attorney, to believe, yeah, that's what this case has always been about.
Your Honor, if I make a correction, we did have the simple negligence proposed jury instruction on the
night before trial, but under the pretrial order, the 5-day deadline, all of the instructions were gross negligence. Am I right?
No, Your Honor. I that's not my recollection of the facts, Your Honor.
Okay. I'll double check it.
We always presented a proposed jury instruction on simple negligence. And the court understood that when it first called the case in June of last year for trial. And, of course, that was the first time, Your Honor, that the defendant, the appellee, made a motion in limine to say we're going to bar the plaintiff from putting on evidence about anything other than gross negligence in order to recover.
Counsel, I don't think you've yet answered the very first question.
I'm sorry?
I don't think you've yet answered the very first question. Why did you not plead simple negligence?
Your Honor, because under the rules of this court, there's no degree of negligence in the case. And for when you file a claim for negligence, if you want to show that the defendant in the case committed something in addition to simple negligence, then we just added the one phrase, the one word, gross negligence, but in the complaint, we talked about negligence. In other words, the rule of the court says there are no degrees of negligence. Under rule, get my glasses up. 3:18, and jump provisions as to pleading. It doesn't separate out whether you have to distinguish between different degrees of negligence when you file the complaint. The reason why we put gross as the word with the negligence is because, based upon the investigation of the fact, it appeared that the defendant had a heightened degree of culpability in this case, Your Honor. So it was not to abandon any particular theory of the case based upon simple negligence. As a matter of fact, Your Honor, if you look at the answer filed by the appellee as a defendant. It defended the case as a general, simple negligence case in its, as far as its defenses. Nowhere, Your Honor, that this case was pending until the trial in 2016 did the defendant suggest otherwise that they saw the case as one of simple negligence.
Well, they actually argued to the trial court something the trial court said it would not consider, though, which was the communications that hovered around the two settlement conference and the mediation conference.
And Your Honor, and that's where the rubber meets the road. That never came up during settlement discussions, during pretrial.
I don't want to get into it either, because I think the trial judge was right in not getting into it, but you said they never made this assertion. They did make the assertion to the trial judge in a brief saying exactly that, that they felt they were being misled by communications, and the trial judge apparently correctly said, I don't want to get into that. That's not something I should address.
And it's your position that they were not being misled?
They were not being misled, and they did not raise that during the pretrial proceedings, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, Your Honor, this experienced counsel, if the court were to think about it, if they were going to make that argument other than on the day of trial, they would have filed something. In fact, the scheduling order said, file your motion in limine for a hearing before the day of trial.
Can I ask one more time, because if I got my facts wrong, I need to be corrected. I thought that the scheduling order, which has a five-day deadline on the submission of jury instructions prior to trial, that the scheduling order deadline, that at that deadline, only gross negligence instructions for the June trial were given to the defense. Is my understanding factually wrong?
It is incorrect, Your Honor. I basically indulge to say that's not correct, Your Honor.
So you gave an ordinary negligence instruction by the deadline of the pretrial order for jury instructions prior to the June 2016 trial?
Yes, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, if I could get into a little facts about this, and I hope I don't go too far on it. When counsel, Ms. Hawk and I discussed proposed jury instructions, and I raised the question of simple negligence, ordinary negligence, and that's when he first told me, no, Mr. Scriven, we're not going to agree to that. And that's the conversation we had when we were drafting, preparing, Mr. Hawk and I, the proposed jury instructions. So he knew at that point in time, when I heard him say that, I said, yes, simple negligence is in this case. He never filed any motion in limine. It wasn't until the trial was getting ready to start, and then I heard them make the comment to the court. And, Your Honor, this case, if I may say, one of the drawbacks is that when the case was first filed, there was another law firm involved in the case. We did extensive discovery when I came into the case to replace other counsel who had not done any discovery without the witnesses. And when we refiled after non-suiting the case, a new law firm came into the case, the present counsel. They did not do any discovery whatsoever. Your Honor, when we get to trial, and
is
I think it's important.
They thought they had a gross negligence claim that on the face of it could never get past a motion to strike, and they knew not to spend a ton of money on it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is it possible the defense knew not to spend a ton of money on it because a gross negligence case like this is not going to get past a motion to strike?
Oh, no, Your Honor, I don't think that. I can't get into their heads. I don't think that was the thinking. I think they realized that it was a case of simple negligence.
Can you direct us to some place in the record where we can find what jury instructions were actually submitted in accordance with the pretrial order?
Yes, Your Honor.
What page is that?
Appendix pages, I'm sorry, page 375.
375?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. 434 through 439 of the appendix is where the trial judge noted our proposed instructions on negligence. He wrote on there objection.
Now, my question is, at the time when the pretrial order had a deadline, I'm looking for the instructions that were submitted to the court. Is that, I'm going to find it there? Because I think you might be talking about later.
No, Your Honor, because as I recall, the scheduling order said submit the jury instructions when you appear or 2 days before, exchange them, and then submit them when you appear at trial.
All right. Well,
that's the scheduling order requirements.
This case is interesting in a number of different ways. I mean, we've often said, with some exceptions, that pleadings in Virginia are notice pleadings. And so I guess the simple question is, what notice does a defendant have that there is a lesser standard of proof that's going to be involved in this case if there's no allegation of simple negligence? And your response is, well, every allegation of negligence, gross negligence, includes as a matter of law an allegation of simple negligence. Is that a fair?
That's part of the argument, Your Honor. Yes, that's part of it. And also the pleadings itself in paragraph 7, it sums up that the defendant was guilty of negligence that caused the damages and injuries and went through that.
So you think paragraph 7 also of the pleadings makes an allegation of simple negligence?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. All right. It just talks about the defendant's negligence.
So your position is that paragraph 7 has sufficient pleadings for simple negligence. That's number one. Number two, even if it didn't, an allegation of gross negligence presumes a lesser standard as well of simple negligence.
Yes, Your Honor.
And last but not least, you submitted a jury instruction in accordance with the pretrial order that had a simple negligence instruction.
Yes, Your Honor.
And consequently, the defense was on notice.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, I just wanted to make sure I understand the progression of your position.
And Your Honor, one other point too. When the plaintiff completed her case in chief, at that point, the court took up jury instructions with the parties. I see the yellow lights on, Your Honor, but I'll finish this one point. At that point, the court was leaning towards ruling that, well, even though I said I was going to look at the facts and simple negligence might be in the case, I think I'm going to check it out. We made a motion at that point before the defense started their case to amend the pleadings, as was the case in the Hayes-Moore case, where they even did it later, I think, in trial than we did. And that was approved, except no proposed jury instruction on simple negligence was made to the court. And the plaintiff said, no, never mind, since we might have to continue the trial.
But why didn't you make that motion in June when the first issue, that was the first trial that ended in a mistrial? Why didn't you make the motion then? Look, if there's some dispute as to what I'm trying to do here, please, Your Honor, let me amend this to add it, the simple negligence count that was non-suited earlier.
Because, Your Honor, in June, the court definitively said, to their request to limit it to gross negligence, that I deny your motion, your objection is noted. We indicated that. At that point in time, it appeared that the court understood that it was going to look at the evidence, see where it went, and simple negligence would still be in the case.
Counsel, during your sit-down time, would you find in the JA, please, where you submitted simple negligence jury instructions before the mistrial in June?
All right, thank you.
All right. You have 1 minute and 26 seconds for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Caroline Davis, here on behalf of David Thomas, the appellee. If I can respond first to Justice Kelsey, you asked for, as well as Justice Powell, where in the record there was reference to the submission of the jury instructions prior to the June 27th record, I beg your pardon, trial. And if you look on page 454, which is a brief that we filed in support of the court's ruling, this does set forth the timeline. This was not denied or disputed by plaintiff, by Mrs. Hunter or her counsel. And very clearly, to be fair, on the eve of the first trial, that is June 26, 2016, by email, we received a proposed instruction for simple negligence. That was the first time we had received any next...
When did you get that?
June 26, 2016, by email.
When was the trial? 27th?
The trial was Monday the 27th.
So it's after the final pretrial deadline?
Yes, Your Honor. It was well after the pretrial deadline. And it was the night before trial, which is why we didn't have time or would have had time to write a motion in limine, but we raised an oral motion in limine at the start of the June 27th trial in light of having received the jury instruction the night before. The court, at the time that motion in limine was heard, a number of issues had been taken up, and the court, I think, very clearly says at the August 8th trial that he was somewhat frustrated with the time we were spending on these pretrial motions. He denied the motion in limine dealing with jury instructions, saying that he would not rule on jury instructions until the time that we argued all of the instructions.
Let me ask you this. On June 27th, so you argued, it sounds like to me, to exclude simple negligence from the case.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me say it this way. It was posed in the sense of the jury instruction because we were getting it for the first time. In fairness, it was also the basis of it was the first time we were being presented with ordinary negligence. And so we were, at the outset, saying, you can decide this now. We think even though we're not having a conference on jury instructions, this is going to an issue that's going to pervade, which is he files a complaint for gross negligence and punitive damages, not ordinary negligence. And when we were back before the court, Judge Swirsky, on August 8th, he said, no, he very clearly told counsel, I did not tell you this could go forward on anything other than gross negligence.
But didn't both, my read of the JA is both counsel left that June hearing thinking that the court had denied the motion in limine and was going to allow the simple negligence.
And just how he did, in fact, deny the motion in limine as it related to the jury ruling on jury instructions at that time. Our inference and concern was that by not addressing a jury instruction or this new claim at the outset, we were going to get muddled in the trial with something other than what was claimed in the complaint.
But I thought what the trial judge said when it came back up in August in the dialogue with plaintiff's counsel, look, you're trying to say I said you actually have a simple negligence count. I never said that. What I said was I wasn't going to deal with it until the end of trial. That's a completely different thing for a trial judge to say.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do you bring a motion in limine before the August trial?
Why did we?
Yeah, I mean, if you go into trial and you don't know whether the standard is simple negligence or gross negligence, why don't you bring a motion in limine and say, Judge, look at the pleadings. There is no simple negligence. Let's make sure that's not in this trial before we even start anything.
Well, Justice, I think in fairness, we believed that he had explicitly and particularly pled gross negligence and punitive damages.
Right.
There wasn't any claim.
So you nail that down before trial to make sure you don't get ambushed. Especially since on June 27th, by June 26th, you knew there was going to be an issue at trial concerning whether that was a simple negligence claim or whether that was not. So my question is, why before trial wouldn't you take care of that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in fairness, we believed and relied on the pleading of gross negligence and punitive damages. We did raise in limine before the start of the August 8th trial because of the ruling on the jury instructions that he wasn't going to hear jury instructions. We wanted it clear that we were proceeding to defend gross negligence and punitive damages. And we did say that at the start of the August 8th trial, which is the motion in limine, and to that he responded very clearly, disabusing counsel that he had not ruled that he could go forward on ordinary negligence.
This was clearly a different kind of trial with different motions and non-motions and the like. But as a practical matter, can one be grossly negligent if they have not been simply negligent? Doesn't gross negligence subsume simple negligence?
Just how I agree that the facts that support gross negligence could and would in most cases support a claim for ordinary negligence. I do agree with that as a fundamental principle. But in choosing what to plead and what to allege in a complaint, the architect of the claim decides which claims to go forward on. And there are many ways to do it. Alternative pleading, perhaps broader pleading where you were not specifying with 8 separate counts of gross negligence being all that you are seeking. There are ways to do it. Certainly, if we believed that he had not specified, was this a gross negligence case, was this a different, then we, it would have been on us to file a bill of particulars. We're not alleging in any way that his complaint, or beg your pardon, Mrs. Hunter's complaint, lacked specificity or particularity. We were clearly on notice.
Well, let me ask you this. If you were clearly on notice about that, why, in looking at paragraph 7 of his complaint, wouldn't you be confused? Because in paragraph 7, he's claiming that there was simple negligence. And then in your answer, you say, we declared there was no negligence in this case, that our client was not negligent. You don't say there was no gross negligence, because that's the only thing you got to worry about. You claim that your client was not negligent.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, let me take the first piece, which is his numbered paragraph 7 of the second complaint for gross negligence. And in that instance, I submit to Your Honor that it is not a separate cause of that. He's not breaking out a claim for ordinary negligence. In fact, the sentence preceding that very directly says, the end of numbered paragraph 6, the last sentence, plaintiff did not contribute in any manner to the collision caused by the sole gross negligence operation and maintenance of defendant's vehicle. He starts the next sentence with, as a result of defendant's negligence maintenance and operation of defendant's vehicle, which is, in our view, I think very clearly, it's referring to what he has just deemed to be gross negligence. And that's an example, Your Honor, but he goes on through, every time he otherwise discusses negligence, it's gross negligence. Sole proximate cause is the defendant's gross negligence. And it is not unimportant that this complaint, the second complaint, came approximately 8 days after non-suiting the first claim.
Can I interrupt you there?
Yes, sir.
That's a heck of an interesting point, and I guess the question is, should whatever ruling we come up with in this case, are we writing some axiomatic principle that governs all conceptual claims for gross and simple or intentional infliction and negligent infliction, et cetera, or do we look contextually at every case and ask ourselves, was notice fairly given? And the most prominent fact, when I'm reading the file, is you get a non-suit on one count, and then you get a brand new count, and it doesn't repeat the non-suited count. I think 99 out of 100 lawyers would think that, okay, well, that's what I'm dealing with. Now, they may be extra cautious and cover themselves against the risk that they're getting whipsawed, but still. So should our holding take into account that fact, or is it logically not relevant because the holding is a pure legal one?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it should, in fact, take into account that fact, because each case is specific. And that's a very important fact for us. Not only did he 8 days later refile a complaint, no new medical information, no new facts were developed in those 8 days. He was counsel at the time of non-suit. I do appreciate his point. He did not plead the original complaint. Mr. Smith did, but he was counsel at the time of the non-suit, for certain, and had been involved in that case. In choosing to refile, he purposely omits a claim of ordinary negligence and adds aggravated liability, gross negligence, and punitive damages, and ups the addendum to $6 million. I said $6 million in the brief. I think there's some, he's clearly asking for more punitives than would be permitted by the law, but technically it is $6 million is what he's seeking. And that's how he proceeds for the next excess 13 months until the new trial.
Am I correct that you all admitted ordinary negligence?
Your Honor, we did acknowledge ordinary negligence.
So if you acknowledged ordinary negligence, how are you prejudiced by the request? And I don't quibble with you about 7. I disagree with my, if that was the position Justice Goodwin was taking. I think they are referring back to 6. So I don't know if, unless it's subsumed, but if you have admitted ordinary negligence, how are you prejudiced at the end if the plaintiff says, now I want to conform the evidence with pleadings and I want to give instructions on ordinary negligence, which they have admitted?
This is how we are prejudiced, because in choosing to our strategy and how we're defending a case for gross negligence and punitive damages, re-elected to focus the lens or the inquiry on Mr. Thomas's conduct.
On his gross negligence.
On his alleged gross negligence. On his conduct. Whether or not, as counsel says, he stopped at the stop sign. What facts went into that? Eliciting cross-examination focused on that. We did not, and I submit to Your Honor, the risk with alleging or eliciting testimony or evidence and contributory negligence is certainly that I can alienate a jury and sometimes inflame a jury. And by focusing the lens broader on her conduct, Mrs. Hunter's conduct, we would have been doing that. I would say this, obviously hindsight's 20/20, but at the time, our decision to focus only on Mr. Thomas's conduct was because we did not believe we wanted to take on that risk, where we certainly believe he could never prove gross negligence or punitive damages on those facts. And so choosing in how we structured our cross-examination, the facts we elicited from her and from her witnesses, including Officer Sawyer, and then the gatekeeper, I believe it was Mr. Whitehead, as well, those questions focused on Mr. Thomas's conduct and what he did. Again, that was a determination we made because we were not defending ordinary negligence. We would have broadened that scope.
In what respect with regard to his conduct and whether his conduct met the standard of ordinary negligence?
Well, Your Honor, we would have broadened the scope with regard to her conduct. We would have elicited facts about when she saw him, how much time and distance. There was testimony about skid marks that we perhaps would have examined differently if we were defending on ordinary negligence.
We
wouldn't have changed the scope on him, Your Honor.
In the criminal realm, everybody is on notice who's a defendant that they could be found guilty of a lesser included offense. It seems to me that in this case, one of the positions he's taking is that borrow that concept into the civil realm. Every civil defendant is on notice, having been alleged to have committed gross negligence, that a, if you will, lesser included concept is simple negligence. Now we're being invited to adopt that as a holding in this case. You're talking about, I think in response to Justice Kelsey's question, and it's a good response, that no, you really look at notice based on each case by case to see whether it's there. Wouldn't it just be simpler to have a rule of law that says if you allege gross negligence, that simple negligence is subsumed therein and you're just on notice that you have to defend it all?
Your Honor, I don't think it would be. Perhaps if it's simpler, that might be one perspective. I don't think that is the case, nor would it be appropriate. I think the litigant who devises the claim, who decides which theories to go forward on. For instance, if you're suing the Commonwealth, there may be a need, a statutory need, by which you cannot maintain, depending on a police officer, et cetera, a claim for simple negligence. So there would be necessarily some exceptions to that. But also, in choosing how to bring the claim, which theories...
Well, you see, that's true in the criminal realm as well. The Commonwealth in Virginia brings the claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
And says you're guilty of malicious wounding. You could be, when it's finally said and done, it could be unlawful wounding, it could be simple battery. But you're on notice that all of the things within that lesser included construct have now put you on notice. And rather than have cases that come up here where we're trying to determine what does paragraph 7 mean, and what does this tendered instruction mean, and what does it mean that it was tendered on this day as opposed to this day, wouldn't it just be a simpler construct to borrow the concept and say, if you pled gross negligence, you have subsumed simple negligence, you're on notice.
Your Honor, I may permission to answer. No, I don't think it would be a simpler concept insofar as you would be taking from the litigant who is making the case and deciding which claims to proceed, that decision and that determination. And I think that, in essence, in certain facts and in certain pleadings, you may have pled both. And I don't dispute, it's just, Kalsa, do you have facts that support gross negligence, wouldn't they also support simple negligence or ordinary negligence? And that is that is one issue, but in a case where you have specifically brought, you have omitted an ordinary negligence claim, you have brought a complaint that says loud and clear, I'm coming after you on gross negligence and punitive damages, and I'm increasing my addendum $5 million, then I don't think there's any ambiguity there, Your Honor. I think he clearly came at us on that, and I don't think there's a... In terms of answering your question directly, would it be simpler? No, because it takes from the litigant the decision in how to proceed in their case. And while I disagree with counsel that these facts support gross negligence and punitive damages, there may well be a case, and there certainly are, where that is a tactical decision that they choose to make without needing or wanting a, if you will, a lesser included in a criminal.
But wouldn't that tactical decision, couldn't it be made at trial by just not submitting the simple negligence instruction?
Well, certainly.
I mean, you're not taking anything away from them.
Well, certainly in Justice Lemon's example, it would be. But as it stands today, a party to a litigation is entitled to be put on notice by the pleadings. That's all we have as a defendant is notice pleadings. And the issues are shaped by the pleadings themselves. And in a case like this, where it could not be any clearer, I would submit to you, what he was pleading or what Mrs. Hunter was pleading. She was pleading gross negligence and punitive damages. We were put on notice of that, and that's how we chose to defend.
All right. Fair
Thank
enough
you,
response.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, 1 minute and 26 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I think the question of Your Honor about when jury instructions were proposed, I think
yes.
It's been answered by opposing counsel.
She did, thank you.
Okay. Also, Your Honor, you asked about the scheduling order in appendix page 12. Mm-hmm. Of course, the jury instructions were not required until the day of trial to be submitted to the court.
It's 2 days, though, before trial for counsel, right?
Yes, we complied with that as well, Your Honor.
Okay.
We would comply with the 2 days for counsel to exchange them.
Did the simple negligence instruction get sent to defense counsel under the pretrial order deadline, which was 2 days before trial?
Yes, Your Honor. I've never talked to Mr. Hall, and we exchanged discussion about it, and I sent it to them. Of course, he had a problem with it.
Because
I recall, Your Honor, I think it was a Friday, either Thursday or Friday, when he and I had that conversation. And the trial was on that Monday. And again, we had the instructions for the court at the beginning of the trial pursuant to paragraph 10 of the scheduling order on page 12. So we did comply with the court scheduling order. Your Honor, quickly to Chief Justice's comment about the rule of gross negligence, including the lesser of. And we think the legislature were thinking about that when they enacted section 8.01-275. And when it said an action of suit shall not abate for want of form, it talks about if there's defects here and there or whatever, it should be disregarded in the interest of justice. In this case, Your Honor, throughout the trial, it must have been 10 or 15 times when the appellee told the court, the jury, we are liable for damages for simple negligence. Your Honor, this is a case.
Now, counsel, tell me your recitation of the best case for you where during the course of this proceeding you clearly made it clear that you also had a pleading of simple ordinary negligence.
Your Honor, I started with the principle at the beginning of the case when at first the court considered the motion of the appellee about simple negligence not being in the case. The court initially ruled in our favor, I thought, and said, your motion denied, defendant. Go for it, Mr. Scriven. I will look at the evidence. And we said in our brief, depends on how the facts and the evidence come out, then I would decide whether to keep simple negligence in the case. Your Honor, as Your Honor observed, we put on evidence about the simple negligence. I guess the surprise came that after we went through this several times with the court, even at the second starting of the trial in August, the court said the same thing again. Start your case, Mr. Scriven. Simple negligence has not been ruled out. And Your Honor, we said the court kept saying that. Only when we got to the point, after we sat down with our case, and the court heard arguments and said, well, I'm going to restrict you to just gross negligence. At that point, the court had all the evidence on simple negligence, Ms. Justice. And at that point, the facts were in. There was no defense for the defendant. They admitted thoroughly that the defendant had committed negligence. And Your Honor, in closing, I just say that this is a case where, because of the admission by the defendant of clear liability, if the court were to grant our request and reverse the verdict, that the case only goes back on the issue of damages because there's no defense to the issues of simple negligence.
Well, thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 10 minutes after 11.